This is Audible.
Colonial Williamsburg, the history of the settlement that became America's most famous living history museum. Written by Charles River Editors. Narrated by Michael Gilbo. Introduction. Quote, that the future may learn from the past. End quote. The model of Colonial Williamsburg. Along with Jamestown and Yorktown, Colonial Williamsburg is known today as part of the historic Triangle of Virginia, but all three of these old Virginian sites are known for vastly different reasons. While Yorktown was the scene of the final climactic battle of the American Revolution, and Jamestown is remembered for being the first English settlement to survive in Virginia, Colonial Williamsburg is now best known as a bridge to the past. Williamsburg got its start as a fortified site, which was vitally necessary for English settlers to heavily outnumbered by nearby Native Americans, many of which were at times hostile. Known originally as Middle Plantation, the site served as the capital of the colony for much of the 18th century, and it bore witness to seminal events in the history of Revolutionary-era America, including the Gunpowder Incident, which nearly coincided with the battles of Lexington and Concord to the north. However, once the capital was again moved, Williamsburg lost much of its prominence, and by the end of the 19th century, it was best known for hosting the College of William and Mary. As fate would have it, a major initiative during the 20th century would restore Williamsburg to a place of prominence, literally. In one of America's most ambitious building projects, efforts were undertaken to reconstruct the main parts of Colonial Williamsburg and restore it to a more original appearance. Whether it was constructing new buildings with the old architecture, or renovating colonial buildings. In doing so, Williamsburg was transformed from a sleepy, albeit historic town, into the biggest tourist destination in Virginia, and America's most famous living history museums. In the 20th century, it was used to teach students about American history and even current events, and naturally it is now a place full of exhibits and historical reenactments. Put simply, there is no place else in the country that can provide modern Americans with a sense of what life was like in the 17th and 18th centuries better than Colonial Williamsburg, which is what makes it so popular nearly 400 years after it was founded. Chapter 1. Winning the Forest. Quote, for 23 years after the landing at Jamestown, the English settlements in Virginia were confined to the valley of the James and to the Accomack Peninsula. Nevertheless, the need of a colony on York River to act as a curb to the Indian tribes seated on a branch of the York River, known as Pamunkey River, had long been recognized. As far back as 1611, Sir Thomas Dale, then governor, in a letter to the Earl of Salisbury, recommended the establishment of a fortified settlement at Chisquiac, some 20 miles from Point Comfort. But probably on account of the peace concluded in 1616 with the Indians by Dale, nothing was immediately done in furtherance of the suggestion. Chisquiac attracted attention again after the appalling massacre of 1622, when, of the settlers in Martin's Hundred, situated opposite on the James, 73 were slain, and the plantation there was so alarmed and weakened that it was temporarily abandoned. Then, in 1623, Governor Wyatt and his council wrote to the Earl of Southampton that they had under consideration a plan of winning the forest by running a pale between the James and the York from Martin's Hundred to Chickisack, from Williamsburg, the old colonial capital. Although England had a history of expeditions to North America by the mid-16th century, they hadn't been making efforts to colonize the region. Instead, English ships, along with those of other European nations, spent periods of time each summer fishing off the coast of Newfoundland in present-day Canada. This was a seasonal activity, however, and there was no sustained European presence in North America yet. Some Englishmen theorized in the 1580s that England needed colonies of its own to challenge Spain's New World presence in Central and South America, and they also asserted that God had set aside the area north of Florida and south of the St. Lawrence River for England and Protestantism. The idea of building an English colony around the Chesapeake Bay area in the 1580s was the work of Sir Walter Raleigh, an English gentleman who had the ear of Queen Elizabeth. The proposed colony would serve two purposes. It would create an English foothold in North America, and be a base from which English privateers could launch attacks against Spanish ships. In essence, English colonial policy in the late 16th century was heavily influenced by privateering activity. Due to Spanish exploration in 1570 and 1571, the Chesapeake was known to Europeans as a great site from which to build a colony, especially because it had sheltered deep-water ports. However, Chesapeake Bay was out of the question for Raleigh and the English, because if it was discovered by the Spanish, a colony based in the Chesapeake would quickly be attacked in reprisal for English privateering activity in the West Indies. Furthermore, the Chesapeake was too far away from the West Indies to be a major English base, and the Spanish Jesuit mission that had been set up in Chesapeake Bay had been destroyed by neighboring Native Americans, giving rise to the belief that the region's indigenous inhabitants were especially fierce and warlike. As a result, Raleigh's first move was to send an expedition with two ships under the command of Philip Amadas and Arthur Barlow, who left England on April 27, 1584, and took the normal southern route to the New World. To cross the Atlantic, European ships picked up the trade winds off the coast of the Canary Islands and sailed west to the Caribbean before moving up the coast of North America. The expedition sighted North America on July 4th, and they landed off the coast of North Carolina on July 13th. The area in which they landed, known as the Outer Banks, were basically a series of sandbars, but after following an inlet into the waters beyond the Outer Banks, they found Roanoke Island, which was situated between the mainland and the Outer Banks. Of course, England's first attempt at a settlement in North America at Roanoke would result in the mysterious disappearance of the colony a few years after it was started, which is still one of the continent's most enduring mysteries. But there were still plenty of reasons for continuing English activities in North America. The Virginia Company, a joint stock company of investors based in London, spearheaded the effort to create a settlement at Jamestown. Based partly on the stories that came out of Spanish efforts in the region, the leadership of the Virginia Company believed that gold and other precious metals were likely present in the Chesapeake Bay region, and the Virginia Company's instructions given by way of advice to the settlers at Jamestown included the directive that men should quickly be sent out to try if they can find any mineral. A second directive asked the settlers to look for rivers or lakes that would lead to the passage of the other sea, thus asking them to find the fabled Northwest Passage. These two instructions revealed the mindset of the Virginia Company's leaders, who planned to recoup their investment in Jamestown either by finding precious metals, the basis of Spain's colonial wealth in the New World, or by finding a western sea route to Asia, which would greatly expand commercial wealth. The Virginia Company's leadership also issued instructions on creating the settlement that would become Jamestown. They wanted the colonists to settle upriver to stay away from possible Spanish surprise attacks along the coast, yet also settle in a location that would be easy for English ships to reach. They also had instructions for dealing with the region's Native Americans. The instructions urged settlers to be careful around the natives because they might attack them at any time. But at the same time, the Virginia Company also recognized the natives as important trade partners, and the Virginia Company's leaders believed the natives near Jamestown would be vital as sources of corn and other food that the settlers could acquire through trade. Jamestown would continue as a settlement, but more influential sites in Virginia would crop up as the English continued colonizing it. By the end of the 17th century, there was already a new capital in the colony, and Jamestown itself was mostly abandoned by the middle of the 18th century. That new capital was none other than Williamsburg. In March 1624, less than 20 years after Jamestown was founded, the King of England, James I, dispatched a group of men to the newly founded Virginian colony to ask its leaders a very important question. Quote, "What places in the country are best and most proper to be fortified or maintained?" End quote. Their reply was that, quote, "The running of a pail from Martin's Hundred to Chiskiak, which is not above 5 miles, and planting upon both rivers, would be the best means to protect the colony," end quote. And this set into motion the founding of Williamsburg. A few years later, at a meeting held in Jamestown in 1630, a plan was made, quote, "For the securing and taking in a tract of land called the Forest, bordering upon the chief residence of the Paiumunki King, the most dangerous head of the Indian enemy," end quote. Furthermore, quote, after much consultation thereof had decree and set down several propositions of land for such commanders, and 50 acres per poll for all other persons who the first year, and 25 acres who the second year, should adventure or be adventured to seat and inhabit on the southern side of Pamunkey River, now called York, and formerly known by the Indian name of Chiskiak, as a reward and encouragement for this their undertaking. End quote. In 1633, a new settlement known as Middle Plantation was established, and during the following year the region was examined by the colonial governor. According to Williamsburg, the old colonial capital, quote, when the governor came first hither, he found James River only inhabited and one plantation on the eastern side of the bay. But now he hath settled divers good plantations upon another river, which lieth northerly from James River, and hath caused a strong palisade to be builded upon a strait between both rivers, and caused houses to be built in several places upon the same, and hath placed a sufficient force of men for defense of the same, whereby all the lower parts of Virginia have a range for their cattle, near 40 miles in length, and in most places 12 miles abroad. The palisade is very near 6 miles long, bounded in by 2 large creeks. He hath an intention in this matter to take also in all the ground between those 2 rivers, and so utterly excluded the Indians from thence, which work is conceived to be of extraordinary benefit to the country, and of no extreme difficulty, in case he may be countenanced from England in his good endeavors, by the state of England, and assisted by the inhabitants here, who for the present are very destitute of all manner of arms and munitions for the defense of the country. End quote. Many of the settlers coming to Virginia at that time were staunch Anglicans, and those settling at Middle Plantation wasted no time in establishing the Middle Plantation Parish in 1633. 25 years later, this church merged with nearby Harrop Parish to become Middletown Parish, which in turn merged with Marston Parish in 1674, to form Bruton Parish. The new parish took its name from Bruton, England, where Sir William Berkeley, then governor of Virginia, had been born. In 1715, the church built its second meeting place, one that is still in use today. Middle Plantation grew steadily until 1676, when rebels led by Nathaniel Bacon burned the colonial capital at Jamestown, and Governor Berkeley decided to move the government center to the less swampy community of Middle Plantation. While Berkeley originally intended this to be only a temporary arrangement, the men of the House of Burgess soon found the higher, drier ground to their liking, and persuaded the governor to return there after the second Capitol building in Jamestown burned in 1698. At that time they renamed the city Williamsburg, in honor of their king, William III. This proved to be an excellent move, for while Jamestown had failed to attract others to its mosquito-infested environs, Middle Plantation was already a popular settlement site and became even more popular in the years that followed. Unlike Jamestown, which was still something of a haven for bachelors, Middle Plantation attracted families with children, which led to the establishment in 1691 of the first school in the colony. One author wrote in 1703, quote, "There are large tracts of land, houses, and other things granted to free schools for the education of children in many parts of the country, and some of these are so large that, of themselves, they are a handsome maintenance to a master. But the additional allowance to which gentlemen give with their sons render them a comfortable subsistence. These schools have been founded by the legacies of well-inclined gentlemen, and the management of them hath commonly been left to the direction of the county court, or the vestry of their respective parishes." End quote. Many of these families were the younger sons of wealthy families, and they wanted some form of higher education for their own sons as they grew up. To that end, as the 17th century drew to a close, a move began to establish a college in Williamsburg. Ultimately, they decided to send the Reverend James Blair to England to plead their case with the king, and in establishing the college, King William named the institution for himself and his wife. Quote, "Whereas we have thought fit that all due encouragement be given to the College of William and Mary, lately founded in our town of Williamsburg, in Virginia, for promoting religion and learning in those parts, we do therefore hereby recommend the same to you, willing and requiring you whatever lies in you for the due encouraging of the college, and in particularly you call upon the persons that have promised to contribute towards the maintenance of this college, to pay in full their several contributions to the end, so good and pious a work may be carried on for the general benefit and good of that country. And so we bid you farewell, given at our court at Hampton Court, the 30th day of December, 1700, in the 12th year of our reign, by His Majesty's command, James Vernon, to our trusty and well-beloved Francis Nicholson, Esquire, our Lieutenant and Governor-General of our colony and Dominion of Virginia in America, or to our Commander-in-Chief of our said colony for the time being. End quote. The two Virginia leaders, proud of having one of only two colleges in the colonies, Harvard having been around since 1636, put a lot of time and energy into their new school. 2 decades later, in 1723, the Reverend Hugh Jones wrote of the college, quote, "The latitude of the college at Williamsburg, to the best of my observation, is 37°21' north. The front, which looks due east, is double and is 136 feet long. It is a lofty pile of brick building adorned with a cupola. At the north end runs back a large wing, which is a handsome hall, answerable to which the chapel is to be built. And there is a spacious 11 on the brick near the south door is the inscription, W.B. 1723. W.B. were the initials of William Byrd, rector of the board. Approached by a good walk and grand entrance by steps, with good courts and gardens about it, with a good house and apartments for the Indian master and his scholars, one houses and a large pasture enclosed like bark, with about 150 acres of land adjoining, for occasional uses. The building is beautiful and commodious, being first modeled by Sir Christopher Wren, adapted to the nature of the country by the gentleman there, and since it was burnt down, it has been rebuilt and nicely contrived, altered and adorned by the ingenious direction of Governor Spotswood, and is not altogether unlike Chelsea Hospital." End quote. Chapter 2. A Brick Capital. Quote, "Duke of Gloucester Street was flanked by two streets, which, taken together, made the founder's name, Francis, the street on the south, and Nicholson, the street on the north. South of Francis Street was a parallel street called Ireland Street, and north of Francis Street was a parallel street called Scotland Street. In the center of the town was a market square, through which ran England Street, at right angles to Duke of Gloucester Street. The other original cross streets were Nassau, King, Palace, and Queen Streets. Botetourt, Henry, and Colonial appear to have been, from their names, of later origin. The ground was apportioned into half-acre lots, and one of the conditions of purchase was that no house should be built within 6 feet of the main street. In a short time there arose, at the Middle Plantation, under the fostering care of Governor Nicholson, a brick capital, the first in the United States so called, and a brick prison. And, to make the street, Duke of Gloucester, from the college to these buildings perfectly straight, it was ordered that the 4 old houses and oven of Mr. John Page, nephew of Colonel John Page, standing in the way should be pulled down and removed." End quote. Williamsburg, the Old Colonial Capital, 1906. After having the College of William and Mary established there, the commissioners next decided that what Williamsburg needed was a jail. In 1701, the commissioners passed, quote, "an act giving further directions in the building the capital and for building a public prison," end quote, which said, quote, "that there be forthwith built convenient to the capital and substantial brick prison, 30 foot long in the clear and 20 foot wide in the clear, 3 rooms on the lower floor, one with chambers above for the jailer's or prison keeper's own use, and for confinement of small offenders, and the other 2 smaller on the lower floor for jails for the criminal of both sexes, to be underlaid with timbers underground to the foundation to prevent undermining, and that at one end thereof there be walled in with a substantial wall 10 foot high, 20 foot square of ground for the prisoners to be let into to air them as occasion shall require for preservation of their life and health, till try all whereby it will be a convenient reception for all criminals upon their commitments, and save the charge which necessarily accrues in each country by keep continual guards upon them, and that the committee for overseeing the building, the capital, have power, and they are hereby empowered to send to England for iron bars, bolts, and all such materials as shall be thought necessary for the same and direct the building thereof, both in these and in all other things necessary thereunto. End quote. The next question, of course, was who should be put in jail, an issue that was not as cut and dry as it might seem. In the early 18th century, many offenses, including murder and various types of theft, could incur the death penalty. At the same time, lesser offenses, such as unpaid debts, could land someone in prison. In November 1711, Governor Alexander Spotswood gave a speech on, quote, the want of a prison for debtors committed by the judgment of the general court, end quote, and he convinced the House of Burgesses that, quote, a public jail for debtors which shall be committed by the general court be built at Williamsburg, that the same be built with brick and be well secured with plank, that it be made 32 foot in length and 20 foot in breadth from outside to outside, that it be called the general court prison for debtors, that the general court have power to appoint the keeper of the said prison and to lay out the rules thereof. End quote. As was mentioned in the above act from 1701, the commissioners also authorized the construction of a capitol building. Not surprisingly, this was the more popular project, symbolizing as it did Williamsburg's designation as the center of power in the colony. Built by Henry Carey, it was completed in 1705. According to the Reverend Jones' 1724 record, quote, the building is in the form of an H nearly, the secretary's office and the general court taking up one side below the stairs, the middle being a handsome portico leading to the clerk of the assembly's office and the House of Burgesses on the other side, which last is not unlike the House of Commons. In each wing is a good staircase, one leading to the council chamber, where the governor and council sit in very great state, in imitation of the king and council, or the Lord Chancellor in the House of Lords. Over the portico is a large room where confederates are held, and prayers are read by the chaplain to the General Assembly. At one end of this is a lobby, and near it is the clerk of the council's office. And at the other end are several chambers for the Committee of Claims, Privileges, and Elections. And over all these are several good offices for the Receiver General, for the Auditor, Treasurer, and upon the middle is raised a lofty cupola with a large clock. End quote. Not only was the capital well built, it was well furnished. Surviving records document the list of purchases in 1703 and 1704. Quote, sufficient quality of green cloth be provided to make carpets off for all the tables. Several dozen of Russia leather chairs be provided for furnishing the rooms above the stairs. An oval table 14 foot long and 6 foot broad. One oval table 14 foot long and 6 foot broad with 2 dozen armed cane chairs, one larger ditto, 25 green cushions for the said chairs stuffed with hair, and a large turkey work for carpet for the table. 6 brass candlesticks and 2 pairs of snuffers and snuff dishes, 2 chamber pots, 4 standishes. End quote. In 1704, Queen Anne herself sent over a most personal gift, leading the colonial leaders to thank her. Quote, to the Queen's Most Excellent Majesty, we humbly presume to make our most grateful acknowledgments for Your Majesty's favor in bestowing your royal picture upon this, your poor colony, by the pleasing prospect whereof, although it be a faint resemblance far short of the incomparable original, we conceive the most noble ideas of Your Majesty's sacred person, in whom do concentrate all the glories of a most illustrious birth, of the most inimitable virtues of mind, and the most admirable perfections of body that ever filled that imperial throne, wherein Your Majesty is ever so happily placed, not only to be a blessing to all your own subjects, but a generous benefactor to mankind. End quote. Over the next several years, further improvements were made to the capital. In 1701, the council, quote, resolved that the wainscot and other wooden work on the first and second floor in that part of the building where the general court is be painted like marble, and the wainscot and other wooden work on the first 2 floors in the other part of the building shall be painted like wainscot, and the doors and other wooden work in the roof shall be painted white. End quote. The following year saw the leaders agree that, quote, the 2 parts of the building shall be joined by a cross gallery of 30 foot long and 15 foot wide each way, according to the figure herein before specified, raised upon piazzas, and built as high as the other parts of the building, and in the middle thereof a cupola to surmount the rest of the building, which shall have a clock placed in it, and on the top of the said cupola shall be put a flag upon occasion. End quote. Now that Williamsburg was the capital of Virginia, it would also have to house the royal governor sent by the king as his representative in the colony. However, when Alexander Spotswood, then the colony's acting governor, technically serving as lieutenant governor under George Hamilton, 1st Earl of Orkney, arrived in town in 1710, he found that the project had yet to be completed. Over the next decade, Spotswood would wage an ongoing battle with the Burgesses to get funding to complete the governor's palace, and he finally succeeded in 1720. In 1724, Reverend Jones described this building, quote, "The palace, or governor's house, is a magnificent structure, finished and beautified with gates, fine gardens, offices, walks, a fine canal, orchards, with a great number of the best arms nicely posited by an ingenious contrivance of Governor Spotswood's. It likewise has the ornamental addition of a good cupola or lantern, illuminating most of the town upon birth nights. These buildings are justly reputed the best in all English America, and are exceeded by few of their kind in England." End quote. The ingenious contrivance mentioned was an arrangement in the front hall of the palace of hundreds of pieces of weaponry, designed to both impress and intimidate anyone paying a call on the governor. In the meantime, Spotswood had been recalled and replaced by Hugh Drysdale, who served as governor until his death in 1726. Then, the following year, Sir William Gooch arrived in Williamsburg to take up the post. In honor of his arrival, the mansion was thoroughly cleaned and painted, with the council ordering in May 1727, quote, "that Henry Carey and John Tyler, gentlemen, be appointed to view the governor's house, and report that reparations are necessary therein, and the charge thereof, and that the same be forthwith set about. And it is further ordered that the great dining room and parlor thereto adjoining be new painted, the one of pearl color, the other of cream color, that the window frames, outer doors, and eaves be also new painted, that the pasture fence be put in repair, and that the laborers be hired to assist the gardener in putting the garden in good order." End quote. Chapter 3. Discoveries and Improvements. Quote, "In his measures of administration, Dinwiddie, though prudent and wise, was not as tactful as Gooch, and consequently was embroiled much of the time with his council and general assembly, who always respected his character, but often condemned his conduct. In February 1759, a Society for the Promotion of Manufacturers was formed, who were authorized by the General Assembly to offer bounties for discoveries and improvements. As large sums were drained from the colony for foreign wines and silks, this body offered £500 as a premium to any person who should, in any 12 months within 8 years, make the 10 best hogsheads of wine, and there was a second prize of £100 for the second best sample." End quote. Williamsburg, the Old Colonial Capital, 1906. Not only was the government involved in new building projects during this time, but the College of William and Mary was growing as well, and before long, Williamsburg celebrated the completion of a new chapel on the campus of its popular school. The Reverend William Dawson wrote to the Bishop of London on August 11, 1732, that, quote, "On June 28, 1732, our new chapel was opened with great solemnity. The governor and his family were pleased to honor us with their presence, and it being the assembly time, the members of both houses came in great numbers, and holy joy appeared in every countenance. July 31st, the foundations of a common brick house for the president were laid opposite to Brafferton building. It is to be finished for £650 current money by October 1733, according to the Articles of Agreement. These two buildings will appear at a small distance from the east front of the college, before which is a garden planted with evergreens kept in very good order. The hall and chapel, joining to the west front towards the kitchen garden, form two handsome wings." John Randolph traveled to England that same month to buy books for the college and to sort out some of the school's financial matters. Dr. William Dawson, then professor of moral theology at the school, wrote to the Bishop of London, quote, "We have a very convenient room for a library over the Indian school. My Lord Burlington, I am informed, has promised to present us with the Honorable Mr. Boyle's picture, which we intend to hang up in the aforesaid library. His philosophical and theological works, together with those which were written by his encouragement, may, perhaps, be thought no improper part of the collection. The books published by our Right Rev. Lord and Chancellor would do honor and service to the college. A complete set of the classics is very much wanted. The President has bequeathed many good editions of the Fathers, etc. End quote. As Williamsburg grew and prospered, it became not just the political but also the social and religious hub of the colony. As such, it often hosted some very important visitors, including the famous evangelist George Whitefield in 1739. He later wrote in his journal, quote, Friday, December 14, 1739, reached Williamsburg, the metropolis of Virginia, by the evening. Saturday, December 15th, waited on, and afterwards, at his invitation, dined with the governor, who received me most courteously. Paid my respects to the Reverend Mr. Blair, the commissary of Virginia. He received me with joy, asked me to preach, and wished my stay was to be longer. Under God, he has been chiefly instrumental in raising a beautiful college in Williamsburg, which is a foundation for about 8 scholars, a president, 2 masters, and professors in the several sciences. Here the gentlemen of Virginia send their children, and as far as I could learn by inquiry, they are near in the same order and under the same regulation and discipline as our universities at home. The present masters came from Oxford. End quote. In 1747, Williamsburg suffered a grave loss when its first capitol building burned down. According to a report sent from Williamsburg and published in the Pennsylvania Gazette, quote, last Friday, January 30th, a most extraordinary misfortune befell this place by the destruction of our fine capitol. Between 7 and 8 o'clock in the morning, the inhabitants of the city were surprised with the sight of a cloud of smoke issuing from the upper part of the capitol, but no fire appeared on the outside. Soon after, some of the shingles began to kindle on fire from within, and immediately a blaze burst out, which presently reached the cupola, then communicated the fire to the covering of the whole fabric. The cupola was soon burnt, the 2 bells that were in it were melted, and, together with the clock, fell down and were destroyed, and the whole covering and roof soon followed. Then the upper floor of the several rooms took fire, soon burnt through, and descended to the 2nd floor, and so to bottom, till the whole timber and woodwork was destroyed, and the naked brick walls only left standing, which, however, seem good except 1 or 2 small cracks in the semicircles. End quote. Following the fire, Governor Gooch insisted that the capitol should be rebuilt. However, many of the burgesses wanted to move to a more centrally located spot in the large colony. While they discussed what to do, the men continued to meet on the campus of the College of William and Mary in the Wren building. Ultimately, Gooch prevailed. In November 1748, the burgesses authorized work to begin on the new capitol. It was completed 5 years later and was used for the remainder of Williamsburg's time as a capital city. In 1790, Thomas Jefferson described it, quote, the capitol is a light and airy structure, with a portico in front of 2 orders, the lower of which, being Doric, is tolerably just in its proportions and ornaments, save only that the intercolumnations are too large. The upper is Ionic, much too small for that on which it is mounted, its ornaments not proper to the order nor proportioned within themselves. It is crowned with a pediment which is too high for its span, yet, on the whole, it is the most pleasing piece of architecture we have. End quote. The years brought more and more sophisticated entertainment to the area, especially when the royal governor was joined in Virginia by his wife and family. This was the case with John Murray, the 4th Earl of Dunmore, who was appointed royal governor in September 1771. The following month, the Virginia Gazette reported, quote, last Friday being the anniversary of our most gracious sovereign's accession to the throne, His Excellency the Governor gave a ball and an elegant entertainment at the palace to a numerous and splendid company of ladies and gentlemen. The Raleigh Tavern, likewise, by direction of His Excellency, was opened for the entertainment of such as might incline to spend the evening there. Plenty of liquor was given to the populace, and the city was handsomely illuminated. End quote. Indeed, the people of Williamsburg seemed to enjoy all things formal and ceremonial, whether attending a ball or laying the cornerstone for a new bridge. Again, the Gazette reported on the latter in 1774. Quote, yesterday the Lodge of Free and Accepted Masons of this city went in procession, in the proper insignia of their order, to the Capitol Landing, and laid the foundation stone of the new stone bridge, now building over Queen's Creek, under which was a plate with the following inscription. Reg Giorgio Tertio, Comiti Dunmore Prefecto, Peyton Randolph Latimorum Preside Supremo, Johann Blair Preside, Anna Lucius, 1774. After the proper and usual libation, they repaired to the house of Mr. Matthew Moody, Jr., a brother, and spent the afternoon in mirth and good humor. End quote. As the social life of the colonial capital developed, so did the town itself. In addition to several churches, businesses, and a college, by the 1770s, Williamsburg was also the home of the first psychiatric hospital built in America. First known as the Public Hospital for Persons of Insane and Disordered Minds, it was founded by the legislature on June 4, 1770, and the House of Burgesses appointed 15 men as a court of directors to run it. The following year, the two-story building opened for business, able to receive up to 24 patients at a time. During this time, which can be considered the earliest days of public mental health care, the asylum was rather progressive, especially since it featured, quote, yards for patients to walk and take the air in, end quote. Chapter 4. Spirited Revolves. Quote, the governor, attended by a numerous retinue of guards, rode from the palace to the capital in a superbly furnished state coach, drawn by 6 milk-white horses. He was dressed after the fashion of the day, in a very handsome, rich costume, and his coat, which was of a light red color, was heavy with gold thread tissue. He made a rather long speech to the burgesses in the council chamber, enunciating very slowly and with frequent pauses, and it is said by those who had heard George III speak from the throne of England that his lordship, on the throne of Virginia, conducted himself very much like the king. He considered it, he said, a peculiar felicity to announce His Majesty's gracious intention that, for the future, his chief governors of Virginia shall reside within their governments. During the 10 days' sitting of the Assembly, the time of the members was chiefly taken up in debate upon the important subject of colonial rights, and terminated in a number of spirited resolves, directly, especially, against the policy of sending Americans to England to be tried. End quote. Williamsburg, the Old Colonial Capital, 1906. By the mid-1770s, Williamsburg was not just the center of colonial government in Virginia, but also a center of dissatisfaction and political intrigue as the colonists began to deal with the ever-tightening grip of British control. As Williamsburg's colonial years came to an end, the Raleigh Tavern, a popular city watering hole, played host to some of the greatest minds of the coming break. Benson J. Lossing, who recalled the tavern's glory days in his book Pictorial Field of the Revolution, wrote, quote, the room used for public meetings is in the rear building of the old Raleigh Tavern at Williamsburg, and up to the day of my visit it had remained unaltered. Carpenters were then at work remodeling its style for the purpose of making it a ballroom, and now, I suppose, that apartment, hallowed by so many associations connected with our war for independence, has scarcely an original feature left. Had my visit been deferred a day longer, in the style of the room could never have been portrayed. In this room the leading patriots of Virginia, including Washington, held many secret caucuses and planned many schemes for the overthrow of royal rule in the colonies. The sound of the hammer and saw engaged in the work of change seemed to me like actual desecration, for the Raleigh Tavern and the Apollo Room are to Virginia relatively what Faneuil Hall is to Massachusetts. End quote. Even Thomas Jefferson himself recalled meeting with other like-minded patriots at the tavern, especially after Governor Francis Fauquier dissolved the House of Burgesses in 1765. In reference to specific events in 1773, he later wrote, quote, not thinking our old and leading members up to the point of forwardness and zeal which the times required, Mr. Henry, R. H. Lee, Francis L. Lee, Mr. Carr, and myself agreed to meet in the evening in a private room of the Raleigh to consult on the state of things. There may have been a member or two more whom I do not recollect. We were all sensible that the most urgent of all measures was that of coming to an understanding with all the other colonies, to consider the British claims as a common cause to all, and to produce a unity of action, and for this purpose that a committee of correspondents in each colony would be the best instrument for intercommunication, and that their first measure would probably be to propose a meeting of deputies from every colony at some central place, who should be charged with the direction of the measures which should be taken by all. We therefore drew up the resolutions. The consulting members proposed to me to move them, but I urged that it should be done by Mr. Carr and my friend and brother-in-law, then a new member, to whom I wished an opportunity should be given of making known to the house his great worth and talents. It was so agreed. He moved them, they were agreed to, and a committee of correspondents appointed, of whom Peyton Randolph, the speaker, was chairman. End quote. Committees of correspondence popped up across the colonies after a crisis arose in 1772 concerning who should rightly pay the royal governor, lieutenant governor, and the British-appointed court judges. The House of Representatives of each colony had traditionally paid their salaries, providing a bit of control over the purse strings many colonists saw as necessary to keep at least some British power in check. However, that year Parliament announced that in the future they would pay the officials' salaries, thus removing any sense of loyalty they might feel towards the colonists. In response to this development, Samuel Adams and his allies organized a group of committees of correspondence in Massachusetts. In each town, a group of men would be chosen to consult together over the current political situation and then to communicate their thoughts to others in the colony via messengers. The system worked so well in Massachusetts that other colonies soon followed suit, and the colonies' committees eventually began coordinating responses to British acts with each other, forming the first political bonds between separate colonies. In fact, they would be the bodies that brought about the first Continental Congress in the summer of 1774. The Committee of Correspondence, Jefferson mentioned, was just one more step that would inevitably lead to the Revolution, and Williamsburg saw one of the earliest actions of the American Revolution. In April 1775, a day after the battles of Lexington and Concord in Massachusetts, Lord Dunmore ordered his Royal Marines to seize gunpowder owned by the local militia and stored in Williamsburg's magazine. Nobody in Virginia was aware of the fighting in Massachusetts, but when the militia heard about Dunmore's order, violence nearly broke out between the two forces. According to a story appearing in the Philadelphia magazine on May 1st, quote, Virginia, on Thursday, April 30th, Lord Dunmore, governor of Virginia, ordered 20 barrels of gunpowder belonging to that colony to be privately removed in the night, on board the Fowey Man of War, a 24-gun ship, which caused great discontent among the inhabitants. The mayor, recorder, aldermen, and common council waited on the governor requesting the powder might be returned, but his lordship's answer being evasive, the inhabitants grew more discontented and began to assemble in different parts under arms. Patrick Henry Esquire marched at the head of the body of the gentlemen of property, volunteers in behalf of the liberties of their country, and from an unwillingness to increase the present confusion, they prudently accepted the value of the powder in money. End quote. For his part, Dunmore later reported to the British secretary, quote, the series of dangerous measures pursued by the people of this colony against the government, which they have now entirely overturned, made me think it prudent to remove some gunpowder which was in a magazine in this place, where it lay exposed to any attempt that might be made to seize it. But though it was intended to have been done privately, Mr. Collins and his party were observed, and notice given immediately to the inhabitants of this place. Drums were then sent through the city. The independent company got under arms. All the people were assembled, and, during their consultation, continual threats were brought to my house that it was their resolution to seize upon or massacre me, and every person found giving me assistance if I refused to deliver the powder immediately into their custody. End quote. Fortunately, disaster was for the moment averted and life moved along normally for a few more months. However, trouble soon broke out again, and on July 22, 1775, the London Craftsman, or Say Weekly Journal, reported, quote, early yesterday morning, the Right Honorable, the Earl of Dunmore, with his lady and family, Captain Edward Foy, and some of his lordship's domestics, left this city and are gone on board the Fowey Man of War, lying at Yorktown. His lordship's reasons for this precipitate retreat are contained in the following message. End quote. Dunmore's message was indeed moving, as it in many ways captured the spirit of the rift that was building up in Williamsburg and the rest of the colonies. For while most colonists were unhappy with how they were being treated by England, many, especially in 1775, still hoped that the unrest was temporary and something could be worked out between the two forces. For his part, Dunmore wrote in June, quote, I have thought it prudent for myself and serviceable for the country that I remove to a place of safety, conformable to which I have fixed my residence, for the present, on board His Majesty's ship the Fowey, lying at York. It is not my intention to give the least interruption to the sitting of the assemblies, but I hope they will proceed in the great business which they have before them, with diligence and earnest. I am perfectly disposed to contribute all in my power, if opportunity be given me, to restore that harmony of every individual." End quote. Upon hearing this news, the Burgesses immediately met and drafted a reply, which they dispatched to Dunmore. They assured him, quote, "that it is with the greatest concern we find by your message to us that your lordship entertains any suspicions of the personal security of yourself or family, as we can by no means suppose any of His Majesty's subjects in this colony would meditate a crime so horrid and atrocious as you seem to apprehend." End quote. They also went on to express their, quote, "concern that your lordship did not think proper to communicate the ground of your uneasiness to us, as from our zeal and attachment to the preservation of order and good government, we would have judged our indispensable duty to have endeavored to remove every cause of disquietude in proof of the great respect we shall ever pay to the representative of our most gracious sovereign." End quote. At the same time, they reminded Dunmore, quote, "how impractical it will be to carry on the business of this session with any tolerable degree of propriety, while your lordship is so far removed from us, and so inconveniently situated," end quote, and urge Dunmore, quote, "that you will be pleased to return to the palace, which we are persuaded will give the greatest satisfaction, and be the most likely means of quieting the minds of the people," end quote. Unfortunately, the Burgesses soon learned that Dunmore's words in his missive were far from sincere, as he regularly sent parties of soldiers to plunder the outlying plantations of those living around Williamsburg. Even the normally placid George Washington, by now the commander of the Continental Army laying siege to Boston, finally declared in December 1775, quote, "I do not think that forcing his lordship on shipboard is sufficient. Nothing less than depriving him of life or liberty will secure peace to Virginia, as motives of resentment actuate his conduct to a degree equal to the total destruction of that colony." End quote. Chapter 5. Entrenchments. Quote, July 4, 1781, Cornwallis left Williamsburg and proceeded to Portsmouth by the way of Jamestown. On the way to the latter place, he was attacked by the Americans under Lafayette, the church on Maine, but the assailants were driven back with considerable loss. Afterwards, Cornwallis, under orders from Sir Henry Clinton at New York, transported his troops from Portsmouth by water to Yorktown and threw up entrenchments. Here he fell a victim to the strategy of General Washington and the combined power of America and France. Lafayette, who commanded the American troops in Virginia, watched him at a safe distance, and on September 6, his army, reinforced by 3,000 men, under General St. Simon from the French fleet under Count de Grasse, lay in small detachments encamped on the road from Greenspring to the halfway house, 6 miles from Yorktown. General Washington's army was at the head of Chesapeake Bay, preparing to move by water, and the commander-in-chief and General Rochambeau were on the way by land in advance of their troops. End quote. Williamsburg, the old colonial capital, 1906. The beginning of the Revolutionary War marked a period of transition for Williamsburg. With the war in full tilt, the newly independent state of Virginia decided to locate its capital further inland at Richmond in 1780. Of course, Williamsburg was still a hotbed of patriotic intrigue. For instance, in 1779, American forces captured Henry Hamilton, a lieutenant governor at Fort Detroit who was known as the hair buyer for buying American scalps from the Native Americans in the area. Due to his atrocious reputation, the former colonists considered him a war criminal rather than just a normal prisoner of war, and housed him in the Williamsburg jail. He arrived on June 16, and according to his journal, quote, "At the jail we were received by the jailer, a character, however, beneath other people's notice, which soon called our attention, and which I shall touch upon elsewhere. The opening and shutting doors and barriers, unbolting some cells, and giving directions in an authoritative voice, perhaps were designed to appall us poor devils, and bring to us a due sense of our situation. We traversed a small court 20 feet square, walled to the height of 30 feet. A cell door was opened. The jailer put us in, and having no further occasion for us, went his way. We had for our domicile a place not 10 feet square by actual measurement. The only light admitted was through the grating of the door, which opened into the court above mentioned. The light and air were nearly excluded, for the bars of this grating were from 3 to 4 inches thick. In one corner of this snug mansion was fixed a kind of throne, which had been of use to such miscreants as us for 60 years past, and in certain points of wind rendered the air truly mephitic. Opposite the door, and nearly adjoining the throne, was a little scuttle 5 or 6 inches wide, through which our victual was thrust to us. It is not necessary to describe the furniture, as such folk as were destined to be residents here had no occasion for superfluities. End quote. Not only did the Williamsburg jail house war criminals, it also held the most serious offenders in the colony. Hamilton noted in his journal, quote, "One was Mr. Collins, who had been a drummer in the British service, but having deserted, no doubt for very prudential reasons, and finding the provincial pay insufficient for the support of a man of pleasure, had fallen upon a method of setting that matter right, by counterfeiting the current money of the state. The second was Mr. Spouse, who had been a victualler in the borough of Southworth. He had his reasons for coming to America, and had an equal right with Mr. Collins to imitating the manner of the engravers employed by the Commonwealth for making what they call limber dollars. A sailor who did not like staying on board was a third." End quote. Nonetheless, life in the Williamsburg jail was not too bad at this time, for while the accommodations were grim, the men soon found ways of comforting themselves. Hamilton explained, quote, "They were all very fond of mirth and rum, the latter greatly promoting the former, so that in a short time 3 of 6 that we were betook themselves to dancing, but Mr. Spears was not firm enough to play and dance long, so he sat on the throne, playing to the other gentlemen, who may with propriety be said to have danced well. These good people, however, had the charity to offer us some rum, which we were not so unwise as to refuse, so laying down in our wet clothes on the board, we passed the night as well we could." End quote. Hamilton only remained in the jail until October 1780, after which he was moved to New York, but while the jail continued to serve its traditional purpose throughout the war, the former royal palace was put to a new and better use. In 1781, the largest and most comfortable home in the city was transformed into a hospital for American soldiers, wounded during the siege of Yorktown. As a result, it was full of sick and injured men when a fire broke out on a cold night in December 1781. According to a newspaper account published in the Royal Gazette of Charleston, quote, "Last Saturday night, about 11 o'clock, the palace in the city of Williamsburg, which is supposed to have been set on fire by some malicious person, was in 3 hours burned to the ground. This elegant building has been for some time past a continental hospital, and upwards of 100 sick and wounded soldiers were in it when the fire was discovered. But by the timely exertions of a few people, only one perished in the flames." End quote. Part of what makes Williamsburg and the surrounding area so famous today is that it not only played a role near the beginning of the Revolution, but its conclusion as well. It was in Williamsburg that General George Washington stayed as he prepared to attack the British at nearby Yorktown. It all began with a glorious entrance into the city for Washington and his men. On September 15, 1781, Colonel St. George Tucker wrote in a letter, quote, "About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Washington's approach was announced. He had passed our camp, which is now in the rear of the whole army, before we had time to parade the militia. The French line had just time to form. The Continentals had more leisure. He approached without any pomp or parade, attended only by a few horsemen and his own servants. The Marquis de Lafayette rode up with precipitation, clasped the general in his arms, and embraced him with an ardor not easily described. The whole army and all the town were presently in motion. The general, at the request of the Marquis de St. Simon, rode through the French lines. The troops were paraded for the purpose and cut a most splendid figure. He then visited the Continental line. As he entered the camp, the cannon from the park of artillery and from every brigade announced the happy event. His train by this time was much increased, and men, women, and children seemed to vie with each other in demonstrations of joy and eagerness to see their beloved countrymen." End quote. While in Williamsburg, Washington stayed with one of the city's leading citizens, George Wythe, and while there he was feted with celebrations and the adulation of those who felt they owed him both their safety and freedom. Tucker continued, quote, "His quarters are at Mr. Wythe's, George Wythe's, house. Aunt Betty has the honor of the Count de Rochambeau to lodge at her house. We are all alive and so sanguine in our hopes that nothing can be conceived more different than the countenances of the same men at this time and on the 1st of June. The troops which were to attend the general are coming down the bay, a part, if not all, being already embarked at the head of Elk. Cornwallis may now tremble for his fate, for nothing but some extraordinary interposition of his guardian angels seems capable of saving him and the whole army from captivity." End quote. After a short stay in Williamsburg, Washington and his men moved on to nearby Jamestown, where they remained until September 27th, after which they once again marched through Williamsburg. Dr. James Thatcher, an army surgeon, later recalled, quote, "This was the capital of Virginia, but in other respects is of little importance. It is situated on a level piece of land at an equal distance between two small rivers, one of which falls into York, the other into James River. The city is 1.25 miles in length, and contains about 250 houses. The main street is more than 100 feet in width, and exactly 1.30 miles in length. At one of the extremities, and fronting the street, is the Capitol, or State House, a handsome edifice, and at the other end is the college, capable of accommodating 300 students, but the tumult of war has broken up the institution. The college is about 130 feet in length and 40 in breadth, with two handsome wings 50 by 30. Their library is said to consist of about 3,000 volumes. Near the center of the city is a large church, and not far from it the palace, the usual residence of the governor, which is a splendid building. The water in this vicinity is extremely brackish and disagreeable. This part of the state of Virginia is celebrated for the excellent tobacco which it produces, and this is their principal staple commodity, though the culture of cotton receives some attention." End quote. Following Washington's decisive victory at Yorktown a month later, the British began treaty negotiations. However, the wheels of diplomacy moved slowly, so over a year passed before American delegates began drafting the Treaty of Paris in November 1782. Due to the time it took to cross the Atlantic, 5 months passed before this news was officially communicated to the people of Williamsburg. In a letter dated April 23, 1783, Governor Benjamin Harrison wrote to the mayor of Williamsburg from Richmond, quote, "Sir, it gives me pleasure to have it in my power to congratulate you on the important event of a general peace and American independence as announced in the enclosed proclamation of Congress, and I have to request that you will cause the said proclamation, together with the one issued by me for the strict observance of it, publicly read in your city." End quote. The mayor planned a truly outstanding celebration for Thursday, May 1st. According to the order of the procession on the great day, the procession featured the following list of people. First, two attendants in front supporting two staffs decorated with ribbons. 2D, the herald mounted on a gelding neatly caparisoned. 3D, two attendants as at first. 4th, sergeant bearing the mace. 5th, mayor recorder with charter. 6th, clerk, behind, carrying the plan of the city. 7th, aldermen, 2 and 2. 8th, common council, in the same order. 9th, the citizens, in the same order. The plan went on to state that while the festivities might begin formally, they would certainly end in a more casual manner. Quote, "The citizens to be convened on Thursday at 1 o'clock at the courthouse by a bellman. After the convention of the citizens, they are to make proclamation at the courthouse, after which the bells at the church, college, and capitol are to ring and peal. From the courthouse, the citizens are to proceed to the college and make proclamation at that place, from whence they are to proceed to the capitol and make proclamation there, and from thence proceed to the rally and pass the rest of the day." End quote. Chapter 6. Comfortably and Well. Quote, "In 1779, the population of Williamsburg was about 2,000, but the removal of the capital to Richmond was very detrimental, and the population dwindled about one-third in 16 years. Mr. Weld, in his travels, says that the town, 1795, contained about 1,200 people, and the society in it is thought to be more attractive and more genteel at the same time than any place of its size in America. They lived comfortably and well, but without any great elegance or luxury. They had neat gardens and a good market, which furnished excellent meals and poultry, fish, crabs, oysters, wild fowl, butter, and vegetables. In 1804, William Taylor Barry, afterwards Postmaster General, was a student at the college and wrote an account of Williamsburg. He spoke of the place as greatly decayed, and of the houses as of very indifferent architecture. He brightened up, however, when he referred to the site of the town and the main street, which were as handsome and elegant as they well could be. The ladies, while not overburdened with learning, were gay, entertaining, and extremely hospitable. End quote. Williamsburg, the old colonial capital, 1906. Once it was no longer the capital of the colony and then state of Virginia, Williamsburg quickly evolved from a center of decorum and elegance to a typical 19th-century college town populated primarily by students and their families. In 1804, William Taylor Barry, who later became the Postmaster General for President Andrew Jackson, wrote about his life as a college student. Quote, "I rise about sunup, read until 11 o'clock, then go to the lecture room. The examinations almost always detain me until 2 o'clock in the evening. I then return and dine about 3 o'clock. The rest of the evening I devote to exercise and company until about 7 o'clock at night, when I commence reading again and continue at it until 11 o'clock, which is good bedtime. This is my general line of conduct, but I do not always conform to it. Sometimes I read less, sometimes more. I attend Mr. Madison's lectures on Friday. They are at once improving and highly gratifying." End quote. Because of its near-constant use for heating and cooking, fire was as much a danger during the 19th century as it had been in the 18th century, and on February 8, 1859, yet another conflagration struck the city, this time destroying the College of William and Mary's main building, which happened to contain an 8,000-volume library. Many of these books were irreplaceable, having dated back to the 1600s and having been given to the school by everyone from kings to bishops to America's founding fathers. The school also lost its science department and the valuable tools contained within, including some originally built by the Edward Nerney, a renowned British optician and maker of scientific instruments during the late 18th century. Fortunately, the college had both the emotional and financial support it needed in order to rebuild, and a year later the following report was made. Quote, "The new college edifice has been completed and fully furnished. On the 11th of October, 1859, the capstone of the building was laid by the Grand Lodge of Virginia, and the college exercises have been conducted in it without interruption from the beginning of the present session. The buildings are in every way suitable, and in eminent degree convenient and comfortable. The lecture rooms are furnished with all the appliances for illustration in the several departments of instruction. The philosophical apparatus is very complete. The walls of the lecture rooms of natural science are hung with valuable pictorial diagrams. The Department of Chemistry is well provided with chemicals and instruments for experiment and research. The lecture room of history has been provided with a full set of the most valuable mural maps, geographical and historical, on the largest scale, and of the most accurate construction. The literary societies of the college have been provided with large and handsome halls, which are furnished in the most comfortable manner. To each of these is attached an apartment for library and reading room. The chapel has been restored, and the remains of its illustrious dead still lie undisturbed within its walls. The library has been conveniently and handsomely furnished with cases for books, and already contains about 6,000 volumes, obtained partly by purchase and partly by the donations of public-spirited individuals. Thus, within 1 year, the losses by the fire of February 8, 1859, have, in every material point of view, been completely restored, and in all the essentials of its building, furniture, apparatus, and library, the college is now in a better condition than it was on that day." End quote. In the meantime, Williamsburg had been visited by the famous scientist William B. Rogers, who had previously served as a professor in the college and gave a moving account of the emotional impact of the fire. He wrote on April 4, 1859, quote, "To my great delight, I found all along the road proofs of prosperous and improved agriculture. The old buntornery, as the Negroes used to call the ruinous charred inn, is now replaced by a hamlet of neat white houses, and on all sides I saw evidences of neatness and thrift. But sad was the sight when about sundown I came in view of the college, as I approached by the road leading past the president's house. Many of the old trees on the roadside greeted me as familiar friends, but I missed the sharp, many-windowed roof of the college, and found, as I drew near, that although the solid walls had for the most part defied the assault of the fire, the whole interior of the wings, as well as the main structure, had been turned to ashes. I drove past, with a tearful eye noting that the mossy coat of the old Beautetort was unscathed, and that the dial kept its place, but that the president's house and our home, the Brafferton, had not been injured, and that one of those noble live oaks at the gate was dead. I drove slowly down the quiet level street, at almost every step recognizing familiar objects, and dwelling in dreamy sweet sadness on the past. As I drove by the old church, whose steeple has never yet been painted, the organ was sounding the closing services, and soon after I reached Mrs. Vest's at the lower extremity of the street on the right hand. She and her husband came to bid me the warmest and kindest of Virginian welcomes. The visitors asked me to confer with them in regard to rebuilding the college. This has been definitely resolved on, and will be commenced on forthwith. The old foundations and the front wall will be retained, but, of course, a more convenient interior has been planned. The insurance money, with what has been and will be collected from friends, will, I believe, put the college in a better condition than before. End quote. Though it was no longer the center of political thought that it had once been, the Raleigh Tavern still served the people of Williamsburg up until the outbreak of the Civil War. In 1859, William Winston Fontaine attended a banquet there, joining a room full of important dignitaries. He confided in his journal, quote, "The dinner was spread in the Apollo Room. Familiar from my boyhood with the history and traditions of the glorious old room, how my heart beat with delight on entering it. It seemed I stood on holy ground. As I was passing down the room, President Tyler extended his hand in that kindly manner of his, which has won him so many devoted friends, and said, 'Take this seat. I wish to tell you of some other things told me by my father of Colonel Henry.' There were some fine responses to toasts by President Tyler, Governor Wise, Mr. Grigsby, O.J. Wise, and other gentlemen. Governor Wise, in his graphic style, drew a picture of the gathering of the members of the House of Burgesses and a few other gentlemen in this old room just after the dissolution of the House. Governor Wise mentioned that when he was a boy he had visited the Apollo in company with an old gentleman who had been present on the memorable occasion, and that the latter had described to young Wise the appearance of these fathers of the Revolution, the groups that were formed, and had pointed out the places in the room occupied by the different distinguished men. 'Twas there George Washington stood, there Patrick Henry with his friend George Mason, there Richard Henry Lee, there Thomas Jefferson.'" End quote. While many southern towns suffered horribly during the American Civil War, few suffered as did Williamsburg. For one thing, calls to service in the Confederate Army so depleted the student population that the College of William and Mary was closed on May 10, 1861, and throughout the war, the college building was repurposed a number of times, first as a Confederate barracks and then as a hospital. In its latter capacity, it treated soldiers wounded in a number of skirmishes fought around the area during the first year of the war. Ultimately, the town fell to the Union Army of the Potomac during the Peninsula Campaign in May 1862. According to a letter published in the Baltimore American, quote, "General George McClellan has come up with the enemy about 8 miles beyond Williamsburg, and after a pretty severe skirmish with his Reed, had again put them to flight across the Chickahominy. There is no doubt that the whole army of Lee, Johnson, and Magruder are in a state of utter disorganization, and under the rapid pursuit of General McClellan, are flying with great precipitation, without the intention of making a stand anywhere. On Monday, the enemy took about 80 of our men prisoners, and captured one of the Pennsylvania batteries, having first killed all the horses. They, having but a small support of infantry, were overwhelmed by a superior force, and were compelled to abandon their guns. But before the close of the day, this battery, with one of the enemies, was recaptured by General McClellan, and the prisoners they had taken were found in Williamsburg next day engaged in attending on the wounded of the enemy they had left behind. The retreat of the enemy was accompanied by too much confusion and haste to be troubled with prisoners. I have heard that the enemy have destroyed all the bridges across the Chickahominy, and that the General McClellan is resting his army on this side. It is the general impression that General McClellan had now got the enemy just where he wants them. End quote. The Battle of Williamsburg left the city in the hands of Northern soldiers, and in the months that followed, the Brafferton building housed occupying Union soldiers. On September 9, 1862, some of them decided to burn down the college building. This was the most egregious of a number of vengeful acts committed against the citizens of the town before the soldiers finally pulled out in September 1865, nearly 5 months after the war ended. Owing to the financial and physical devastation the war brought to the area, first by the Union Army and later by Reconstruction, the college was not able to open again until 1869, and even then it only managed to remain solvent for 13 years before closing again. It was finally reopened as a state school in 1886. Meanwhile, some level of prosperity had returned to the city. The Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad was completed in 1881 and featured 6 stations in and around Williamsburg. Some of the tracks once ran down Duke of Gloucester Street. According to a September 15, 1881 article in the Harrisonburg Rockingham Register, quote, "The completion of the peninsula extension of this company from Richmond to its deep water terminus at Newport News affords the only nil rail route in existence to visitors to the centennial celebration at Yorktown of the surrender of Lord Cornwallis and his army. The celebration commences on October 18th and continues until October 21st, inclusive. This line, traversing as it does the entire length of the peninsula of Virginia, passes through the principal battlefields of that region, among which are Chickahominy, Malvern Hill, Seven Pines, Fair Oaks, and many others. It also passes through the ancient and historical city of Williamsburg, near which place a branch has been built to the Centennial Grounds, and from thence direct to Newport News, the junction of the James River with Hampton Roads. Excursion tickets will be sold throughout the country, and though cars run direct to the grounds via the Chesapeake and Ohio Railway in conjunction with the many lines of railway connecting with it." End quote. Chapter 7. Often Visited by Travelers. Quote, "Peace came at last, and Williamsburg, shattered by poverty and war, took up again the burden of its destiny. But the Virginian, true to his English descent, never yields to despair, and, after the old Confederate soldiers returned, the houses of the town were repaired and the main college building rebuilt on the old walls of 1694. In 1881, the centennial of the surrender of Lord Cornwallis at Yorktown awakened new life, and the Chesapeake and Ohio Railroad ran its cars through Williamsburg not long after. In 1888, the college, which had been closed for 7 years, was revived under the patronage of the state legislature. Then, in 1893, the bicentennial year of the college charter, Congress, by an appropriation of money, made amends to a considerable extent for the injuries afflicted by war, and since that time Williamsburg has greatly improved. The ancient capital has its face toward the future, while proudly conscious of the past. It is often visited by travelers from Europe and from the North who never fail to take away with them kind impressions of the neighborhood, and love to repeat in letters to newspapers and other periodicals the interesting stories of its ancient glory. The present population is about 2,500. End quote. Williamsburg, the old colonial capital, 1906. At the dawn of the 20th century, Williamsburg was in many ways a typical small town where slowly decaying historic buildings stood shoulder to shoulder with the more recently built homes and businesses. The difference, of course, was that Williamsburg's slowly decaying buildings were of national interest and had not only witnessed some of the most exciting and important events of American history, but also played a role in them. Another difference was that Williamsburg had the Reverend Dr. W.A.R. Goodwin, an Episcopal priest serving at Bruton Parish Church. In 1907 he saw the fulfillment of his initial dream for the city, that the church which had stood for so long would be restored and preserved for future generations. Goodwin was eventually transferred to upstate New York for a time before returning to Williamsburg in 1923, and by this time he had a new vision, restoring the entire town to its Revolution-era glory. Using contacts he had made during his career, he got in touch with John D. Rockefeller, Jr., the son of the infamous Standard Oil magnate and philanthropist John D. Rockefeller. In the spring of 1926, John D. Rockefeller, Jr. traveled with his family through Virginia, visited Williamsburg, and fell in love with the rector's vision. With Rockefeller's help, Goodwin purchased the now popular George Wythe House, home of the famous patriot who, among other things, taught Thomas Jefferson law. This was a logical purchase since it stood next door to the restored Bruton Parish. Rockefeller did not commit fully to the project until November 22, 1927, which is now considered the starting date of the restoration project. As the men quietly brought up houses and land in the area, they also planned out the legal foundation for what became the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, the organization that would manage the property and oversee the museum. Finally, they held public meetings in June 1928 to make their plans known and to persuade the local citizens to help them. While there was an overall sense of enthusiasm, there was also some wariness, especially on the part of Major S.D. Freeman, who pointed out, quote, "No consideration has been given to the broader aspects of this transfer. If you give up your land, it will no longer be your city. Will you feel the same pride in it that you now feel as you walk across the greens or down the broad streets? Have you all been hypnotized by $5 million dangled before your eyes? Can any one of you talk back to $5 million? If we close the contract, what will happen when the matter passes out of the hands of Dr. Goodwin and Mr. Rockefeller, in both of whom we have perfect confidence? Who will control? We will reap dollars, but will we own our town? Will you not be in the position of a butterfly pinned to a card in the glass cabinet, or like a mummy unearthed in the tomb of Tutankhamun?" End quote. Nonetheless, Rockefeller and his men ultimately triumphed, sometimes offering life estates to those who would sell their homes to the foundation. This became a particularly attractive prospect for many, especially when the Great Depression hit a few years later. William Graves Perry, of Perry, Shaw, and Hepburn, served as the project's lead architect and oversaw much of the measures taken, including the destruction and removal of more than 700 buildings that had been put up in the city after 1790. He also supervised the rebuilding of the governor's palace and the Capitol building on the original sites. Of the two, the governor's palace was much more faithful to the original, but the latter enjoyed plenty of fanfare when it was dedicated on February 24, 1934. The following year, Rockefeller Jr. wrote to his father about a ceremony held there. Quote, "The General Assembly of Virginia, the governor, and other officers of the state were all most kindly in their reception of us, and the session which they held in the reconstructed Capitol was dignified, impressive, and in every way appropriate. There were some 200 men in the group and as many wives. The wives could not get into the Capitol, but heard the exercises over amplifiers in the theater in Williamsburg. After the morning exercises, we gave a luncheon to the entire party, which followed a reception, thus giving us an opportunity to meet and shake hands with each one. In the afternoon, the guests visited the several important buildings and went back to Richmond on their special train about 5. In his address, the governor made reference to what had been done in the restoration of Williamsburg and also to the far-flung philanthropies bearing the name of Rockefeller. End quote. Over time, about 500 buildings were either restored or rebuilt on the property, which extends to the campus of the College of William and Mary. A handbook for the exhibition, Buildings of a Colonial Williamsburg, Incorporated, published in 1937, observed, quote, "Through the restoration of many buildings which had survived, and the reconstruction of others which had disappeared, the Williamsburg restoration has sought to recreate this large and varied scene. The official guidebooks of the city now list some 70 structures which, though privately tenanted, contribute to the general representation of the colonial city. This publication is immediately concerned with the 6 exhibition buildings of Colonial Williamsburg, Incorporated, which are now open for public inspection. 5 of these buildings, the Old Courthouse, the Capitol, the Public Jail, the Raleigh Tavern, and the Governor's Palace, were among the most important public buildings of the colonial city. As such, they were selected for early restoration or reconstruction. The Ludwell Paradise House, the colonial townhouse of Philip Ludwell II of Greenspring, now contains Mrs. John D. Rockefeller, Jr.'s collection of American folk art. Ultimately, it is hoped that this list will be enlarged to include furnished dwellings representative of the various social categories and structural types. In addition to shops, similar to several already opened, representative of the arts, crafts, and trades which are known to have been practiced in Williamsburg in the 18th century." End quote. Obviously, the massive restoration carried out by the foundation had a major and lasting impact on Williamsburg itself. In 1931, Luther Gulick wrote in Modern Government in a Colonial City that the, quote, restoration of Williamsburg is the embodiment and symbol of our colonial heritage, makes it impossible to continue there the small-town government that has come down through the generations. This truth is recognized by the city's government, the city's representative in the state legislature, and the governor of Virginia. Early in 1930, three important steps were taken to meet the situation. A new city charter was drafted as a basis for discussion, combining and clarifying the various laws dealing with the powers and organization of the city. A full-time city engineer was appointed, and the Institute of Public Administration of New York City was asked to make a thorough study of the organization and finances of the city to serve as a guide to the mayor and council in dealing with the city's problems. End quote. Of course, no project is perfect, and the problem with Rockefeller's vision was that it was limited to the more charming aspects of colonial life, an idyllic vision of noble men making speeches while delicate women looked on adoringly in fancy frocks and well-behaved children rolled hoops in the grass. Consider the following letter he wrote to his father in November 1935. Quote, on Saturday last, the college had its annual home day for the alumni. A parade was gotten up with many floats representing different historical scenes, in which the college students, both boys and girls, took part. In the parade was the old coach of the Revolutionary period, which we have bought and have done over just as it was in those days, driven by a colored coachman with a footman standing on behind, both in gorgeous blue livery of the day with knee breeches, buckled shoes, and cocked hats. In the coach, the windows of which were open, sat four really lovely hostesses of our exhibition houses, all dressed in the costumes of the period. I wish you could have seen what a charming picture the whole combination made. End quote. It is evident that Rockefeller had little to no interest in dealing with the less attractive aspects of life in the 18th-century city. While this was not a problem during the project's earlier days, as the country changed in response to the civil rights movement, a push began to emphasize the role of African Americans, both slave and free, in the museum. Today, much is made of the role of all the peoples who lived and worked in the city, as costumed reenactors stroll the streets, anxious to engage visitors in conversation about what life was like in the city during the 1770s. Naturally, there are many visitors each year, especially since people can walk Williamsburg's sandy roads at no cost during any time of day. The foundation supports itself through private endowments, merchandising, and selling tickets to those who wish to enter certain buildings. It also makes a profit from the several restaurants that cater to those visiting the museum. Thus, a visitor can go into a rebuilt local tavern and have a meal, marveling all the while at what the original tavern would say if its walls could talk. This has been Colonial Williamsburg, the history of the settlement that became America's most famous living history museum. Written by Charles River Editors. Narrated by Michael Gilbo. Copyright 2012 by Charles River Editors. Production copyright 2015 by Charles River Editors.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.